And we're on.
We are?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, title screen, though.
Oh, but we are still on the title screen. There we go.
Yeah, welcome everyone. This is on.net. We are live. Fantastic. And today we have Carl, Wes, Imo, and Kendra.
Oh, hi, yeah. Me, I am totally here. Hi, everyone.
Yeah, and I'm Bertrand Leroy. And today we are going to talk about how triage and project management is done on the .NET Core project, which is going to be interesting to people, I think.
Oh, yeah. Like, we always get questions of, like, why is this bug not resolved? Or why is my feature not in yet? We want to talk a bit about how that works.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, so you noticed that, yeah, out of five people in this room, three have very short hair.
Shiny heads.
But not a single Scot in the room. So
yes.
That's exceptional. All right. And we're also in the new new studio. We can draw on the walls now, which is pretty nice. So if you want to draw on the wall, you can, but you will be away from the mic and nobody will hear you. So you have to choose between writing and talking. So
that's true.
All right, so let's talk about this.
Yeah, so I think one on our side, like what happened over the last, I would say, 2 years, we learned quite a bit on, you know, how to triage bugs on GitHub, how to use labels effectively, how to, you know, respond to bugs and inquiries. And we have changed our processes, I think, along the way a few times. And then quite recently, Carol joined our team and he's very eager to drive some numbers down. And we did, I think, a much better job of responding to people and driving the number of issues down. In particular, the thing that we care a lot about is API design. And so usually what happens is somebody says, I would like to add an API. And then we say, great, give us an outline of how that API should look like, how you would use it. And then nothing would happen for 3 months. And the question was, why is that, guys? Like, I submitted all this stuff and like, why is nothing going on? And so I think last time when I was here a few months ago, or weeks, I guess, I don't know, we talked about .NET Standard.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that changed on our side is that .NET Standard and .NET Core were fully divorced, meaning we can add APIs to .NET Core and not having to think about how this impacts any of the other .NET platforms. And that's a major change, which finally allows us to actually add APIs and not having to look at the entire universe that we have. And so we can actually make decisions much, much faster. And so like all the issues now that are going to be API additions, we're doing, you know, I think a much better job of actually getting through the backlog and driving that number down. And I think over the last 4 or 5 weeks, we've probably approved more APIs than we did in the last 6 months.
Okay, so if I file a bug now, about how long would it take for it to be triaged?
That's a good question, Carol. How long does it take us?
That's a good question. So we're still like ramping up on the triage of the various areas. So how we actually treat that is that when the bug comes, there's a kind of repo triager, which is me, Stephen Dow probably, and sometimes Dan Mosley kind of chips in. And the only kind of our role is to say like which area it is. And then we rely on the area owners to kind of look at the issues and like use their experts. To, you know, tell more about that. Of course, sometimes we chime in, like Stephen Taub knows everything, right? I know nothing, so we try to help here and there, but mostly we're relying on the experts in the area to kind of go and triage. And I think that in end of September, we started kind of telling this to the area owners and experts, like guys, like, yeah, you gotta be on top of those things. So in ideal world, I would expect that in few days, week most, you're gonna get answer. We're not there yet. We are there with some areas that where we kind of like did the initial triage. We, you know, so kind of went through the backlog, you know.
How big is the backlog?
Well, we have 1,500 bugs in CoreFX repo. Mm-hmm. We didn't look, by the way, on CoreCLR yet that much. That's going to be the next step. The CoreFX is kind of more popular at people adding APIs and things. So over there for the 1,500s, I think that we're done with 70%, 80%, that it's kind of triaged, which is pretty good. Again, you know, it gets the area experts kind of, you know, it takes time to put them in the mode like, guys, yeah, you should pay attention to new things. And, you know, GitHub is not making it quite easy for us to do. So we have some tooling around that. But anyway, so to answer your original question, like how long it will take, what I would like it to be is like a week most to get some answer, ideally even much less, but again, you know, let's shoot for something reasonable. In some areas, which haven't been especially triaged or where we kind of didn't quite establish the cadence, it's gonna take a little bit still longer. But what I'm trying to shoot for, if someone notices like that, ping me on Git, hey, this is not getting the attention, and we can either say sorry guys, we don't have the owners lined up yet and experts, or we can go say we missed things. Mm. And we will miss things, with the number of 1500 issues, and I think that every day we have, I would guess, 10, 20 new bugs coming in, we're gonna miss things. Again, not intentionally, but something will slip through.
Okay, so we're open source, right?
Oh yeah.
So.
But we're perfect, right?
Yeah. I'm getting to that. So we're open source. So we have contributors, and we have people outside of Microsoft making very valuable contributions. You talked about experts. Are any of those non-Microsoft people who are triaging bugs actively?
That's not the current state, no.
Is it a place where we want to get eventually?
That's a good question. I don't know answer to that. When you look at that, the external contributors, there are two types of issues, right? There's the issues as in bugs, someone says, hey, I have this problem, or hey, I would like this API, or this is broken. And then there's the next level is kind of submitting PRs. Here's a fix for that issue, or adding these APIs. We have quite some number of active contributors, especially in some areas. By the way, Link has half of all the contributions, which is interesting. Apparently, very very popular. On number of PRs coming from kind of contributors. So, what was your question again?
external.
If we want to triage kind of from external people. So, the first step that we're actually looking at, especially in Link, we have so many active people. Bart Desmet is actually a Microsoft employee, but he's in Bing, so he's not kind of in our organization. So he's not doesn't have the insights that much about CoreFX and those things. But we kind of starting reopening the question: should we give these contributors more write permissions and allow them to kind of are they trusted enough? Do we trust them with that they keep all the standards that we have on the base, or do we need the kind of real owners or experts in our area, in Link, for example, do that? We don't want to kind of open it for everyone. You probably want to have some gates, some kind of checking that this looks good, and only people who are more experienced kind of potentially giving them right access. We started discussing that there's no good answer. There are pros and cons and maybe legal implications and things, so it's an open debate. So right now we don't have that even for that. And honestly, if something
and it can also bleed into governance territory, which is even
From a triage standpoint, I don't think external contributors are going to be. We're not going to ever put them on the hook for triaging areas and stuff like that. But providing feedback and guidance and stuff like that, definitely. Yeah. There's lots of that already coming in. Where they're providing feedback.
But it is possible for anybody to look at bugs and determine if they are legitimate and repro.
They chime in all the time, before we do sometimes on a lot of the issues. So.
And we have active contributors like that, quite non-trivial numbers. Yeah. So again, so the kind of how I view the triage is more for us making sure that if no one from community kind of took a first step at it, that we don't leave things behind.
We push the communication on the issue a little bit. Get back to Carol's point earlier about 1 week time frame for triaging. Mm. That's at least starting a conversation, having a conversation, not necessarily having a resolution and having something closed.
Yeah. So it's getting the issue acknowledged and looked at.
That's
and
so some things are a lot easier than others, and some issues take a long time, even if we are actually actively working on it for the whole time. So
the one thing I want to point out, because you mentioned open source and being transparent and open and having external people or giving them power, the one thing that I think is challenging for us is that if you look at GitHub, basically there's multiple roles, I guess, that are mixed together in this repository, right? If you compare this to, let's say, Linux, where there's different artifacts and there's different roles and different basically different styles of what's the bar, right? So for example, if you want to get your fix into, let's say, the networking layer in Linux, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens is you have your own fork of the repository, you can do whatever you want in your own fork, obviously, but if you want this to become part of the official kernel, what you do is you don't talk to Linus directly, you talk to some of the maintainers. Mm-hmm. And then there's a chain or a tree, if you will, of decision makers that are there. And then Linus himself, he only pulls from a bunch of people that he trusts, which are all in the community. But that's basically just the, what does Linus think what his kernel should look like?
Mm-hmm.
And he gets free reign, like he doesn't really have to answer to anybody because that's, like, everybody just agrees that he makes good decisions and we trust him. But then on the other side, you have all the distro providers, you have Red Hat, you have a bunch of others, and they usually have their own issue tracker, they usually have their
mm-hmm.
own patch queues on top. And on our side, all of this thing is basically mangled together in one repo, where we
mm-hmm.
say the official source for the .NET Core, you know, BCL, if you will, is the CoreFX repo. But we also happen to be the maintainers. We also happen to be the party that offers official support. So that makes it a little bit harder for us to delegate this to external people that, for example, don't
sure.
have the context on, you know, what does support look like? What happens if you have security issues? If we're on the hook for those decisions. And like in Linux world, where you have distributed basically repos with distributed roles and responsibilities, it's a bit easier to say, you know, Linus doesn't have to worry about this thing. This is Red Hat's problem if they have to roll out a fix.
Mm-hmm.
On our side, it's one party. And that's why I think it has pros and cons, as Wes said. The one thing that is easy on our side is that there's only one repo to worry about. You only have two. There's not 500 parties you have to align with. But it also means that there's more decisions to be made when you want to get into that repo. And that makes the bar somewhat higher from the get-go. But I also think that's not necessarily a bad thing. It also sets expectations. Everybody understands what it is that they're getting from this whole
mm-hmm.
thing. And I could imagine a world where we actually have multiple layers. I mean, we already have an agreement with Red Hat, for example. They will probably start maintaining their own source copies eventually, that to have their own, like, you know, patch queues if they really have to. So yeah, I could imagine a world where this is heading in that direction.
Right, because we already have some, let's say, trusted partners who are part of the foundation.
Right.
You mentioned a couple, but there are others, and they are not Microsoft.
Right.
And they participate in governance decisions. We imply them in early discussions on a number of things. So, did those guys actually express interest in participating in, you know, the daily nitty-gritty process of maintaining the repo?
I mean, I would say it depends. I mean, like if you look at multiple repos that we have, the one thing that is happening right now, which I think is super interesting, is that if we look about touching existing bits, there's a shit ton of like constraints we have. But for new stuff where it's more like unconstrained, like especially CoreFX Lab, where we build a whole bunch of new features that sometimes have runtime implications, the compiler implementations, implication I should say, there is where you actually see people that are external being almost on equal footing with the people on our side. You look at Ben Adams, and there's like three others whose name I forgot, but they're working with us on Span, for example, and they are pretty much like one of the key consumers that we have. And so there is where the world between Microsoft and non-Microsoft completely blurs. Like if you just read the PRs, you wouldn't be able to tell unless you know the people.
Mm. Okay, so where does it happen? Is it everybody in his office looking at bugs that are tagged in their own area? Do you do meetings where you
we
look
have
at
some scheduled meetings for our team? We basically have a couple hour. We have two-hour sessions scheduled per week. This
mm-hmm.
time we spend like 1 hour of that every week, just basically walking through the things that are ready for API review, and that's exactly what we do. We get in a room and we start hammering through and try to make progress on getting feedback going on that. Then there are other times are basically for larger design reviews or APIs or issues that we need to have more team agreement on. So we go in and we just use those time slots to discuss those design issues. And then there's also everybody on their own office kind of like going through issues. So I know he probably spends a lot of time just sitting every hour of the day, basically looking at incoming issues and then tagging them and such.
Not that much, as I actually say, said, like we're trying to, you know, distribute it among the experts of the areas. And we have right now, it's not very super well promoted, you know, description on GitHub who owns which area. Not that like contributors or whoever files bugs should care about that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, as soon as I mark, you know, basically at the label, like, hey, this is link or this is system data, the people in next hour will get email like, hey, there's a new issue in your area, which again, we rely on them, you know, to go and take a look at that. So what Wes said was mostly about the APIs. One, again, I think that what I want to point out that while like there's a kind of core group of people who I'm not part of that, or I'm sitting in, I'm not in the core group myself, who are experienced actually in API design and reviews and, you know, all the teeny tiny things and like the history, like it's by Simo and Stephen Daubt,
Christoph,
right, you know, Eric St. John, and, you know, a couple of other people. So, you know, these people are very valuable to do kind of the final API review and the kind of thumbs up, thumbs down. What we try to do that, you know, the area owners or experts kind of do the first level kind of API review. As I'm like, yeah, this looks sane, you know, if I look at it, you know, looks reasonable. I think that it has a decent chance to pass through the API review. And then these guys will kind of like pull it apart and say like no to half of the things, or like no, you should change this and that. So, so we have that even distributed, that stuff. So, and the kind of the first level triage, or even the kind of first level API approval by own area owners, is happening, as we said, like in the offices, kind of like on everyone's cadence. Sometimes we have two owners of an area, like collections and runtime on other things. And those people sometimes choose to kind of have weekly meetings or twice a week or something. And, you know, we kind of leave it to everyone, like work as they want, you know, on those things.
So if somebody is interested in having an early look at the results of those discussions, should they look at the GitHub repo and the issues, or is it on the issues that most results of those appear?
When we started, I think we swung the pendulum, I guess, to 100% transparency and see how far we get with that. And so, for example, what we did is, like, the meetings that Karen was just mentioned, we actually recorded them and streamed them live, and then I actually went through the meeting and basically published notes for that. The problem so there's two issues with that. The first thing is it's somewhat labor intense on our side to actually do this every week, because as we said, it's like two-hour slots that we have, so it's quite a bit of work. The second problem that we have is that, you know, the question is it worth it, right? That's always the question. And what I found is that, I mean, I think I uploaded like 100 or so design review meetings on YouTube. And I think most of them have, let's say, about 150, 200 views at most, which is, you can say, is a lot. But at the same time, like, consider that this is like 6 months after the fact, right? Usually when you start, and we had like maybe 10 people chiming in, but this whole curve declined as well. So what we found is more useful is that we basically have, if you look at the reviews, we basically have two kinds of reviews, I guess. One of them is, okay, we have like 10 issues, probably each of them takes us about 10 minutes to get through, and then we just crack through them. For those kind of issues where it's like, okay, here's two overloads I wanna add, what do you guys think? That really doesn't warrant necessarily a video plus detailed notes. It's much easier to just respond to the issue on GitHub with a comment that says, we looked at this today, here are the few bullet points you need to worry about. And so there's no dedicated note section for this particular issue because it's the issue itself. And then there's the other kind of reviews where we've done this in the past when we shipped completely brand new feature areas that take all of Rosin, for example. We did like, I think, 3 or 4 meetings that reviewed the entire service area of Rosin. That, I think, is a good example where having a one-off video that just shows one thing and one thing only makes more sense, because from a consumption standpoint, who's going to watch a 2-hour video where we review 30 issues? That's not very interesting. If you say, here's one review that's dedicated to ROS, and if you care about ROS and you want to know why we did certain things the way we did, that's the video you probably want to watch. But otherwise, it's a poor return of invest, because you watch a 2-hour video and then you find the 10 minutes that you actually care about, but it's like too damn hard, I think, for both parties. I would say right now, we don't have many of those big features, which is why we also stopped the recording more or less. We did a few things over the last year that were, you know, controversial internally, controversial externally, which was .NET Standard and how we model this. And it's a great example where open source is both good and bad, because if you have problems getting the people that work on the product on a daily basis behind an idea, you don't want to open the floodgates and invite even more opinions, because that makes it even harder to get consensus. And so there's this balance between, okay, let's first get a story straight that we can say, okay, this is a story that we think we should be doing. And then we open up the floodgates, and then we adjust the story from there. Otherwise, you have 100 different stories with 1,000 different opinions. And then, like, how do you ever get to consensus or a idea that you can drive? And so I think that's something.
Right, but you are going to get those opinions sooner or later.
But it's easier if you get the opinions on one story than if you get the opinions on 10 stories.
True.
I think that's the kind of balance we're striking. But yeah, I think there's definitely room for improvement. I would not claim we're as transparent as we could be or should be. But I think we are kind of open to feedback. I mean, like, there's plenty of information on GitHub. I mean, these people are on GitHub quite a lot, and you can always ping us and say, this area, I think it doesn't work very well. Let us know what's going on. And we try to adjust this quite a bit.
Okay.
So the one thing I should point out, by the way, is like, we are working on CoreFX, right? So I'm not, I think we shouldn't pretend that we speak for all of .NET, right? Like, first of all of .NET is not even just Microsoft anymore. There's Exynos and a bunch of other projects that are also in the foundation that have their own processes. Roslyn has a very different process, for example, because they do language design. They have to be even more conservative on how features work, and they have their own processes around this. We are specifically talking about the core runtime slash base class layer that we happen to maintain. So most of the concerns that we have, other people may not have, or they have other probably concerns and constraints.
Okay.
Sounds good, right?
So we talk mostly about API design issues. We still get quite a lot of just bug reports and other type of issues at Triage. Those are usually going to be handled by the owners area. Just take a look and investigate and like figure out how they're doing. But the open source community also goes in and tackles a bunch of those things too. I think we've gotten more in the habit of marking things up for grabs, so like to open the door for community members to just feel it for you to step in and tackle some of those problems too.
Yeah, that's actually in the I call it initial triage we started in September. We're, as I said, almost 70-80% of done is basically, going through all of that, find out that, oh, shoot, we didn't answer for a year. That's not a good idea, right? Maybe we should answer. Maybe we should say hey, this API has these problems, or not only API, but bug report and those things. And part of that is as well marking things up for grabs, encouraging community, someone wants to grab it, there you go. It sounds reasonable. It kind of passed through the first level, sanity check. It doesn't mean that, when someone submits a bug fix for that, it's going to be taken, because, sometimes when you work on code, you find out that, the original blessing was actually wrong because we didn't anticipate all the, problems in the implementation. But again, it's pretty rare. It doesn't happen that often.
Because you're pretty smart.
Yeah, you're pretty smart. So we're marking things as up for grabs, trying to be more open with community and encourage them, and or not only encourage them, but as well give them the opportunity to contribute. And we have quite a lot, a lot of interesting contributors. And we're trying to be as well open and transparent with the milestones, as in now 2.0, not 1.2 anymore. And hey, these things, we really think that it has to happen, something has to happen in 2.0 versus we cannot promise that, and if we cannot promise that, let's move it to future. It doesn't mean that if it's in future, we cannot fix it in this, or we will not take a PR for the bug fix, but we ourselves at least don't plan for do that. It's kind of up for grabs, it's there. Come and join us, come and help us.
But okay. Kendra, do we have any questions on the Twitters and places?
Not that I can see.
Okay, so I should probably have said at the beginning of the show that you can ask questions on Twitter. Just use the hashtag onnet,
O-N-N-E-T,
and we'll do our best to answer. So you talked about up for grabs. What's the process for people to find those issues and solve them?
There's a simple query. It's actually on the CoreFX main page on the README MD. The only problem of that query is that it contains both things, the API proposals and as well all the bug fixes. So, with the API proposal, right now we're marking it like API needs work plus up for grabs, which basically means we need API proposal, which is different work than it's just go and implement it.
Right.
So that's, we need to add a couple of more links and explain that, because again, from a newbie, people who are used to CoreFX report, they know already, but it takes, 2-3 issues to find out, that's what it means. That's the 1+1 together, right? So so getting to up for grabs is easy. Sometimes you can stumble up on things that might not be as simple for.
If you're a newcomer, you should probably not jump directly to API design. You should probably aim for something maybe.
However,
a little more.
The problem is that APIs. I think new APIs is sexy, right? Everyone wants
to do that. It's like language design. Everybody's a language designer.
So honestly, we get lots of more interest from people. Or again, I'm not entirely blank check, but especially from new people when they jump in, I can work on new APIs. Great. It's well, we have lots of bugs as well, and you know, perf enhancements, and like just making things better, things. But again, you know,
we do get a fair lot of contributions for just people adding test coverage, which is awesome.
Yeah.
We love that too.
Yes. But those are mostly engaged, already engaged kind of contributors who found that, like, you know, hey, I can actually make a dent and make contributions as well other ways.
Yeah.
And like Hugh was, I think, one of the top contributors even in a few months back on some, you know, increasing test coverage and that stuff. And
yeah,
so we welcome all types of things.
Yeah, both test and documentation are great first contributions, because you get to actually dig into an area of the code that you don't know in advance and discover it and understand it, and then you can share what you discovered.
The documentation that, you know, we don't have a great story for contributing documentation at this moment.
We don't?
We don't. Like it's
You mean on APIs or
on APIs,
in general,
on the
we
API
do have
reference.
The
so there's the docs for the conceptual things.
Yes,
we do.
Yes.
Not on the APIs and the terms slash. It's
okay.
A little bit, you know, it's not crystal clear. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but it might be, it's confusing even for me. Let me put it this way. So that's something actually worked with docs team in the last few weeks, and hopefully come February timeframe, we should have a really good story. I want to make sure that we have like, hey, this is how you contribute to documentations. Right now, we even don't know what's the thing. Like, should you go and change the triple slash commands in CoreFX repo?
Yeah.
Or should you go to the docs site? How those things will match together? When? What? Like, there are not good answers at this moment. Again, docs team is working on tooling and stuff. So, you know,
but
we're going to get solution.
Conceptual documentation is possible to contribute
absolutely.
To. It's docs.microsoft.com. And it's there is a GitHub repo. What's the repo, do you know?
Docs.
Oh yeah, it's .NET/docs.
.NET/docs.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry, I was looking at the CoreFX
viewpoint.
Yes.
Sorry. Yes.
But be prepared to have all of your typos fixed by our docs team. They are relentless.
Yeah, I know.
But I have to actually shout.
We know.
I have to actually shout out to Myra from docs team. That when we talked, actually in the last few weeks, we started like, you know, pulling her on some issues where we said like, yeah, okay, already from the community, we know exactly what to change. Here's the original text. Here's the new text. It makes sense. And actually, there was a really fast turnaround on these things. It's still kind of unofficial. She has to do it in some tooling somewhere for MSDN docs. But so there are ways how to get there. It's just not very well streamlined.
Yeah, and we are in a transition phase.
Yeah,
yeah.
We're
moving
there.
From MSDN to something a lot more open and a lot more flexible, where the time to get the docs online is much shortened. And
so in CoreFX repo world, we're not ready for someone to come and start submitting 100, you know, changes to the documentation in CoreFX repo. We might be ready in the docs repo.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
But it's just APIs. Who needs docs?
Yeah.
Well, that's true. Who needs tests, right?
Tests? What,
what is that, right?
Okay, what else do you guys have to say about all that?
So the only other thing that I think maybe worth interesting, like, Wes and Carol, can you talk a bit more like what does the process look like when we actually add stuff to CoreFX? Because we also have the full framework, right, which is completely not open source.
You're not allowed to say full framework.
Sorry?
You're not allowed to say full framework.
Full framework? Did I say full framework? I meant .NET framework.
Yes.
Capital F. Of course. That's one of those things that our doc teams relentlessly fix in our documentation. Like, you can't use that term.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is certainly a challenge that a lot of the more senior folks on our team pay attention to for all the issues is like, well, what does it mean if you're going to go make this change, or is this breaking change for other places or other platforms? You can make this change. Yes, it looks like a bug in .NET Core. If you make it now that it behaves different than .NET Framework, do we want to take that? Mm-hmm. Is it really worth the difference? Who knows? In some cases, it's always case by case basis, but. We'd like to have people be able to copy C# code from the internet somewhere and be able to run a .NET Core and .NET Framework and have a sort of similar set of semantics. So whenever we take a change that's actually a difference in semantically, we try to figure out. You might start seeing we tag a lot of issues with NetFX consider. Like
port consider.
Port consider, yes.
Yeah.
That's basically a flag to us, to our tooling, to say, like, file an issue for the .NET Framework, we might actually need to take this issue there to have a consistent behavior between both .NET Core and .NET Framework.
And that's actually not a promise, as in like, we're gonna take that. That's why there's the consider in that. Like, you know, yep, we're gonna consider it, we're gonna review it carefully when it's ready to kind of spin off the new not quite full .NET framework, right?
But why don't we just take all the changes and just jam them in the .NET framework?
You want us to answer that question?
Yeah, okay. It's an obvious question. You know the answer,
we
right?
At one point, I think 1 million customers have been pushing fixes to the .NET framework and breaks somebody every single time we touch the .NET framework. That's the reason why we don't do that.
That's a good answer. And,
The compatibility is actually an important part, especially in the framework. I think in .NET Core, we could kind of break out from that quite a bit, that we're side by side. Basically, people upgrading is kind of, it's their option, so they can take a little bit of breaking changes, even not too much. Again, everyone
also
likes like breaking changes unless it breaks their application, right? You know, and that's the challenge. In .NET framework, we have the challenge that actually pushed out via Woo Windows Update and stuff on all the machines. And you know, you break interesting applications at interesting time frame, like, you know, 2 days before tax return and those type of things. And those are the horror stories we have around. So that's, we have to be really extra careful about those things. And as was mentioned, like, you know, we want as well, you know, code to be copied, and we want actually libraries to be able, you know, not care and not have if checks, like, oh, if I'm running on full .NET framework, do this, and otherwise do something else. So that's why actually even compatibility between the full framework and .NET Core matters. So sometimes we say like, yeah, you know, it's a great API change. You know, if we would start from over, we would take this change in the behavior of this API. It doesn't make sense. But, you know, if we take it, it means that almost every, you know, half of the libraries that are out there will have to do if check what to do on that platform, on another platform. So is it worth it? Is it worth the complexity that we enforce on the library writers? Oftentimes the answer is no. Like, again, if it's corner case, we don't think it's large impact, like, sure, let's do the right thing. But
yeah,
the ship has sailed, unfortunately.
There are tons and tons of cases where we've broken things and where we thought it was completely innocent change. Adding a new API on a type, well, yeah, that breaks things too. Like, we added a property like a couple of releases ago and broke some random serialization scenarios, and like, well, I just added a property, come on, why can't I do that? We've had plenty of scenarios where we just added a private field and it broke things. Like, binary serialization is very sensitive to these type of things. Like, every change we make, it seems like it breaks some scenario. So essentially any change is a breaking change to somebody. It's just we have to.
Yeah, and when you have millions of users, you are guaranteed to break stuff. I mean, it's.
Yeah, I mean, if you just do the math, we have 1.8 billion installations, and if you think you're really good and you're 99% compatible, that's not enough.
Yeah, it's like clearly
you have
not
to
enough.
Be 99.9999% compatible. I mean, you mentioned breaking changes. I mean, the one thing that often comes up is, why don't you just use Semver? Right? Semver solves all versioning issues, apparently. At least some people believe that. The problem with breaking changes is, first of all, we don't do breaking changes. Like traditional definition of breaking changes, like removing APIs, renaming types, renaming namespaces, we don't do those sort of things. But what we do
not
is
not deliberately, at least.
Well, sure. Like, there's people that submit PRs for that, and we say politely no. But like, the problem that we run into is that, as Wes said, in many cases, if you look at a change, it's traditionally you would think of it.
Yeah,
as
a change of behavior is potentially breaking. All
like
of them.
Any bug fix is a behavior change, which means it is potentially breaking, right? Or like any API additions can be, depending on how you use the API, can be breaking, and so the after like, I don't know, 15 years, basically, you have to think about whether the add of the feature is worth the risk of taking the break, essentially. And on our side, the fundamental thing, I think, is people sometimes say, oh, if somebody does something unreasonable, like, for example, let's say a private reflection and they extract the value of a field, well, just break them. They did obviously something wrong. That also sounds great in theory, but in practice what happens is you have Windows, you have the .NET framework on Windows, you have a bunch of apps running on that, and some of the library authors did something that was fishy, right? But as an end result, if it's a popular library, it still make break hundreds and thousands of apps across the globe. In which case we could say, yep, I mean, was it unreasonable what the library author did? Yes, but is it reasonable for us to still break hundreds of thousands of apps? No, so we still have to unroll the stick. So it's like this case-by-case thing, and in many cases, we do these changes, and then we, you know, slowly roll them out, and then you basically have to live with the fallout. And then, so that's why we basically say, okay, .NET Core was created specifically so we have basically a playground that was designed to be not immediately going to be globally visible to everybody on the planet. And so we can actually do these things. You have, you know, side by side, you have the ability to just run the local changes first, and then we can like slowly, gradually take them back. But in the end, we still want to have a story where you can write your app and run them in multiple different .NET platforms. So consistency is still something we care about. That's why we still don't do super aggressive random changes on .NET Core that we just can't see ourselves taking back to the full framework. I guess that's the answer to that.
Also, just to add to that, this is an anecdote. Like early in my career, one of the things I did was I was quite naive. And like, this behavior is clearly broken. Why wouldn't I fix this behavior? It's not even returning anything close to what it's supposed to return. So I fixed his thing. And like 3 or 4 months go by, right? Like I got called like into the ship room, war room, right before we shipped, and like I got like yelled at quite a lot because I fixed the behavior of this thing. And it broke a whole bunch of people. And like, because they had worked around the broken behavior, they basically, my fix actually broke their workaround, so they were busted. So I had to roll that back, and I learned quite long the hard way about like, just because it's broken doesn't mean you can fix it either. So
because people take dependency on the broken thing.
Right.
Sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally,
yes.
Actually. And it's like, it's always the benefit versus, impact. Like, do you want to break so many? Is it worth the risk to break so many people?
Yeah. So the one thing that I think we should point out though as well is that for .NET Core, our goal is not to have bug compatibility with .NET Framework. So we did make changes on CoreFX that we wouldn't necessarily do in full framework because the behavior was like completely messed up on the corner case. But it's impactful on .NET Core in many cases because it's cross-platform and you may run into those corner cases more often. So that's why we have more flexibility on .NET Core, but it's not that we use the flexibility to do breaking changes. We just do them for the greater good, I guess. But at the end of the day, the expectation is still is on .NET Framework. The problem is the framework gets updated after you shipped your app. Versus on .NET Core, you upgrade at design time and you're still having Visual Studio around. And so if you upgrade and something is broken because you did something stupid or you accidentally took a dependency on a broken behavior, then that's the time that you can fix it because you still test for that. Versus on full framework, well, you ship your app, so now it's on thousands of computers, and then Microsoft pushes an update and now your app is broken. And then when you have to rectify that, that's very expensive, and that's why we don't do that.
So we still have that. We still have that possibility of for critical security updates, for example, to push changes
on the core side.
Yes.
Yeah, on core it's a bit more nuanced, I guess. I mean, you want to talk about how that works?
So the bar is much higher, right? But
We will only take really, really critical things and push them if we have to. We have some mechanism in place to do it, but it's going to be very rare that we'll ever do it.
But we have the same things on .NET Framework, the security fixes, on pushes, GDRs, MSRCs, whatever we call it, right? So I assume that we have the same plans for .NET Core. The problem on .NET Framework is that actually from time to time, really half a year or a year, you have a major update. And then it's not about just the security fixes, which are extra reviewed and very careful crafted. Like it's suddenly lots of bug fixes, and that's the problem.
Those are in place updates.
And we don't have that with .NET Core, or we have it, but it's the kind of developer's choice. Yes, I want to run on the next version, and of course we expect the developer.
It's
app
by
app.
It's not always wide.
I think it's commonly referred to as my mom made a change to her computer just by taking an update versus the developer on their machines taking an update to the tools. And the developer can make some changes and adjust to it, but my mom can't do anything about it.
And there's actually, with .NET Core, we have great way how to kind of react to that. Because like first 2-3 developers hit something and say like, guys, you just broke this, like it's painful to work around and things like that. We're like, yeah, you know what, okay, let us quickly ship yet more new patch which reverses that thing, which means that, okay, maybe tens of developers will be affected. Again, not great for them, but not everyone, right?
We have
time kind of, or we have like options to go and churn quickly and react quickly.
Package by package.
In the .NET framework, it's like, we are shipping yet, when you break something, you break everyone at once, then you get all the feedback, and then, oh, so you scramble, what do I do? How do I undo the badness, right? And then you hope that no one took, in the meantime, dependency on the new badness that you created.
Of course.
It happens, of course.
The one thing I would say is that on .NET Core, it works slightly different from full framework in the sense that the way we push is, there's not a single mechanism. There's multiple mechanisms we have. So for example, when you consider .NET Core in the context of UWP, where you have an app store, we know all the apps in the app store because they're on our app store, and like we know which versions of binaries they have been using to build the app. So when the shit hits the fan, so to speak, there's multiple options. One option is you can just patch the apps. Another option is we can reach out to the author and tell them, you were impacted by this, you have that much time. If you don't react and test your app with a new fix, we will still fix it for you, but that means your app may be broken. So there's multiple venues that we have to actually roll out fixes. And then if you consider on the other side, like on the ASP.NET side, you look at Azure that actually hosts the website, there's multiple options you have. But as a .NET core application author, you almost always have the ability to say, screw this, I package my own app, I statically link everything, but that means you're now on the hook to actually roll out fixes, right? But that means you can choose whether, you know, how much control you need. If there's an app that you actively maintain, that you push out pretty much every week or every month updates for, you may be better off of just saying, you know, I'm in full control because, you know, you will be able to actually test your fixes. But the problem is also when you look at the larger enterprises, not every app is like that. I mean, we have plenty of internal apps like the connector apps, the thing that we use for our buses, for example. They're not actively maintained by a large pool of developers, right? At some point they're done and they move on. And then if those apps have bugs, it's still nice to have an internal mechanism to say, you know, we just push an update. If the app doesn't work, fine, somebody will take care of that. They will fix the bug and then they will have a new version. So I think there is this, you know, push versus pull model. I don't think there's one perfect model. I mean, with Framework, we went all the way with push. And I think once you get big, push certainly has a very high risk because your hammer is so big. But we have seen other cases of like Heartbleed, for example, where it's very important. If you have something that everybody runs, then yeah, maybe everybody needs to jump because otherwise really bad things are going to happen.
So we started by talking about triage. You talked about our side of it, where we look at the bugs that are coming and triaging them. Can you give our audience some hints about the best ways to file bugs so that they get properly triaged? Is there anything people should know about what should be included in the bug and how to make sure that the problems you care about get the proper attention?
So that's a very good question. That has been bugging me for years, actually, even before .NET Core and open source. It's like, you know, what's the right bug report? You know, there are articles on that. I have read some actually interesting things, you know, what you should do and that stuff. Mm. I would love to have something like that, either linked from CoreFX repo or not. It's hard, like, you know, or hard.
Well, there are some obvious mistakes. I mean, shit is broken, for example, is not going to be very helpful.
Yeah. My app doesn't work. Please help. Like, okay, you know, that's not enough information, right? I think that the best advice is always imagine you're on the other side. It's your application, and someone tells you this type of report. Do you know where to look? You know,
do you know where to start? Yeah.
That's one angle. The other angle is actually people, like, again, like, it doesn't happen on GitHub that much, luckily, but people tend to like, you know, hey, here's my large solution. It doesn't work. Go. I was like, you know what, debugging that stuff, it's gonna take a couple of hours usually, kind of, you know. Mm. What I love is like, or my typical question is like, do you have a minimal repro?
Yeah.
You know, once you have minimal repro, and honestly, lots of stuff is, you are able to distill down to a couple of lines or maybe small classes and like, here's the repro. It's work to get that.
Yeah, it is work, and sometimes you actually discover what the issue is.
Yes, and interesting that. Things, oftentimes, again, talking about .NET framework and about like kind of customers, oftentimes when they did that, they're like, oh yeah, like let's say 70% of cases, it's actually a bug in their code.
Yeah.
And by distilling into small repro, they find out, oh, okay, it's my fault, right? Mm-hmm. You know. That's what people oftentimes don't see, and like, why are you making me, you know, spend the time on small repro? Like, it's your problem. Like, go fix it. Like, you know, well, how do you know until you can pinpoint what it is?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's actually somewhere in the middle. Like, you say, like, oh, it's definitely .NET Framework problem, and you find out that, let's say, it's in the upper library, or it's somewhere in Visual Studio, or
Compiler. Or sometimes it's your mistake, but you were actually pushed in that direction by an API that's not properly designed, for example.
Yeah. So
right.
So if I have some wish for like great reports, it's like, you know, think you're on the other side and think like, you know, how to make it as simple as possible for, you know, people jump in like, yep, it's clear that it's at least in this area, in this API.
Yeah, it needs to have all the information. You
know, yeah. Well, all is sometimes, that's another angle, like people like, well, you know, oh, yes. I have tried this gazillion of things.
There
like,
is. There is such a thing as too much information as well, right?
Yeah, there
are bug reports that are, you know,
numbers
of text.
My personal number one bet that I see internally, externally, I've probably committed that plenty of times myself, is that people would give you a bug report and say, I did X and I got an error. But they wouldn't tell you what error they got. That is so common. It's like, if you get an error message, please provide the error message. I mean, that's super helpful. Because for the most part, it's like, they say, I couldn't build. Well, what happened? Was it compiler break? Was it a NuGet break? Was it MS build? Was it, like, what actually happened? There's like millions of things that could have gotten wrong. And by not providing error message, you're not really helping you. In many
cases, stacks are helpful in some cases as well.
Stack traces are helpful. The other thing I sometimes see is that people, we just got a bug report like 2 days ago where somebody did something. You look at the description and I'm thinking to myself, I'm almost positive you got a build warning earlier that basically told you this will not work. And so sometimes just by reading your own error messages that you got, some chances are it already tells you that the bug is on your side. So like, yeah, if you have an error message, include that, it would be super useful. And the other thing with GitHub is, I don't know whether you know this, but they have now in Markdown this thing called, what's it called, details, like a detail tag, where you can basically provide additional information, but it's collapsed.
Oh,
so
yeah,
you can progressively like have more stuff show up. It's super useful.
I sneezed, sorry.
Are you allergic to bugs, is that it?
Yes, that's what it is.
Oh. So those are for bug reports too, but like for my API design point, we like to see like a sort of like the API surface, if you will, like a just a small DOM marked up DOM.
And not only that, we oftentimes need motivation, because like people assume that, oh, you're on BCL team, you know everything. Like, no, that's not how it works. You know, yeah, we have experts for areas parts, but you know, the more, again, sometimes too much information is too much, but you know, explaining like,
having,
you know,
some
hey,
context.
This is the context, this is the thing. And sometimes I've noticed that, you know, I ask people and, you know, kind of play dumb, not intentionally, but you know, hey, I don't have expertise in this area. So I ask like, how would you use it? And then you see people like, well, this way, of course, like, how come you didn't think about that? Like, oh, sorry, you know, not the expert.
Why is it important?
I
we
never
don't necessarily
this,
know why it's
right?
important.
You know, Nick Craver is actually, you know, will get then some reply like that from me very soon, because looks like that his SIM version or the version popular API actually don't quite understand, or you know, people of, you know, talking with them like, you know, how exactly is it gonna be used, you know, and that's a person who is really experienced, like, you know, have faith in him and like, you know, and everything, but you know, it's hard to really think about like what, you know, you have to see in the head of the other side. So I think that, you know, one thing would be like, yeah, try to think about the other side, and then next, like, you know, if you get even stupid questions back, it's not trying to push you off. Just be patient, because just people don't know everything, right?
And in many cases, I mean, like, especially for API design, like, yes, at the minimum, you want to see the proposed API surface. But I honestly find that in some cases, it's helpful because you want to just add an overload, right? And clearly, that's easy. But if you just, let's, for example, push for a new type or a new set of types, I actually don't care about every single API on those types. What I care much more about from the get-go is some sample code on how do you expect the feature to be used, because then you can kind of picture together the larger picture in your head without knowing all the nitty-gritty details on every single method on those types or every single API on those types. And then in many cases, it actually informs almost all the remaining design decisions, like, oh, you want a fluid interface design, or you don't want that, or you want operators, or you don't want operators, or you want that to be a struct versus a class versus whatever. And like in many cases, like the context of like, how would you use this? When would you use this? What's this primary for? Convenience, performance, just capability, whatever. That actually has helped many cases to completely not do certain designs. So I think that's, if you look at some of the bug reports we get now, or I should say feature requests, most of them have that now. I mean, I'm actually say like almost all the API reviews requests we get are actually relatively well written, because pretty much everybody like followed what some of all the contributors did. And it's actually quite nice to read.
Plus, you're seeing the stuff that has been already processed by the first level triage,
right?
So,
right.
You know.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that. I mean, it's leading by example on both sides.
But yeah, it's getting definitely better. Another thing, actually, that you know worries me in the space is interesting is that not every API is actually best suited for CoreFX, and that's actually sometimes hard message to send back. Cause like, you know, I'm kind of pick examples like, so, you know, people wanted like, oh, it would be great to have like lots of, you know, sorting algorithms or something like that. It's like, yeah, it's a good idea, but does it need to be in CoreFX, right? You know, I think there's that kind of, we don't do great job in explaining people how we think about the core FX or the BCL. And actually, the for example, JSON.NET, right?
Yeah. So that
it's library on top of. It doesn't have to be in the CoreFX itself, right?
Well, some people disagree with that.
Exactly.
So what are the criteria that you use?
Now look at emo.
So I would say the general challenge here is that it's not black and white, right? Like it's a gray area, right? And almost any system where you have a bunch of principles, the principles will be in conflict, right? That's why you have design discussions, because you try to find the trade-off between the principles you're having. So this particular example, like why is JSON.NET not part of CoreFX, or why is it not part of .NET Standard? It's more or less the same question. And that has to do with, well, who are we trying to help here? Because at the same time, some people may think that's super awesome for the consumption of JSON.NET. It might not be super awesome for the producer of JSON.NET, right? James Newton King does a really good job making sure his library is available everywhere. Mm-hmm. If we put it in CoreFX, well, now suddenly it's a bit harder, because now the question is, if it actually ships in the BCL, it ships the full framework, maybe he has now a harder time actually producing updates for that, right?
Okay, so that's an interesting example, because it's a case where the community actually came up with a great solution,
right.
And we decided to say that, to bless that solution in a way.
Right.
So I'm involved in the Orchard CMS project, and we have similar problems where we have to decide, okay, what kind of feature should make it into the distribution, and what should be an optional module that you download from the gallery.
Right.
It's very similar. Mm-hmm. And the criteria that we use are actually pretty simple. Basically, if it's a feature that almost everybody is going to use,
mm-hmm.
then it can get in.
Right.
And some modules begin as external modules and get pulled into the core later.
Right.
So in the case of JSON, one could see something similar where, okay, well, the exact library is should be something external, but having the functionality of JSON serialization is something that, I don't know, you probably have the telemetry on that, but 90 up something of
right.
applications are using some form of JSON serialization somewhere.
Right.
So should JSON serialization, not necessarily JSON.NET,
so I think
be in there?
I think you have an interesting point here, which is there's multiple angles here, right? So one of the angles is, in .NET we strive for a batteries included experience, right? A file new project gets you something useful, gets you, started very quickly. And I mean, if you look at JSON.NET, that's the experience you have, because if you do file new ASP.NET web app, you have JSON.NET available to you. The fact that it's in a different repository and done by a different person is almost something you couldn't tell. I mean, you can tell because the APIs are in a different namespace, but that's almost irrelevant, because you could imagine that JSON.NET would be in, let's say, system.text.json. Still done by the same guy. Still
sure, but,
separate but
new ASP.NET project does contain a lot of stuff.
Oh yeah,
if you do new console app, that's a completely different story.
True, but we could say that if you do file new project on the console app, you also get JSON.NET by default, right?
Yeah.
It's just like what packages are referenced by default.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily have to do with which repo the stuff is in or who is actually building it. And I think that's actually a good thing, because for open source, you always have a system where you have multiple cooks. And sometimes things don't play out. I mean, I think we tried, 4 JSON serializers? And they were all garbage.
We do have a JSON serializer in CoreFX, actually. It's just not that great.
And so I think sometimes there is this value of like being external, because you also have less constraints from the get-go. You can actually do something much faster.
Yeah, but having a JSON serializer in the framework doesn't mean that it eliminates the possibility for external libraries. For instance, string is clearly something that should be in there, right? But there are string implementations that are third party for very specific usages, right?
I think string is an interesting example, because I mean, like if you look at the way the project is structured, there are certain things that have to be in there, right? String has to be in there because other things have to use string, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to agree on the type.
Yeah.
And we have this with other new stuff they've been working on. Span of T will probably be in the similar
sure.
book, where it has to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's things that could be in there but aren't in there, and then
mm-hmm.
sometimes for various reasons. But I would say the general statement you made, which is is should we actually have something JSON in the framework that doesn't suck, right? And the answer is yes, we should. Mm. And we are working with like James Newton King in some places. For example, when we introduced buffer pooling and we looked at span of T and some other things, we said, well, we would like to have a high performance JSON reader. Mm. And we would have by high performance we mean low allocation, you know, very resource aware. And we could just build our own, or we could work with him to come up with a design that we're all happy with. Mm. And that maybe is the one that we ship with CoreFX moving forward. But I think there's always going to be this point in time where somebody externally does something innovative that we not necessarily buy in yet, because the industry as a whole hasn't bought in yet. Mm. And that's also a good thing, because it means on every successful library like JSON.NET, there's probably going to be hundreds of failed attempts at like an awesome library. And we would all put them in the framework from the get-go, then you have like a lot of garbage very quickly.
Sure.
So there should be something like a, okay, like let's talk about the successful ones, and then let's have a conversation how we can leverage them, and if we should leverage them, or if it should still be on top. And I think that will be a case-by-case thing. I mean, there's another project in CoreFX Lab that is equally big, which has to do with datetimes, right? The framework datetime APIs have their problems. And fixing this, there's various attempts. I mean, there's Noda Time, which is basically part of the Joda Time library that Java has. It does a really good job of daytime computation. And there's this question, should we have something like that in the framework as well? But those are probably areas that are not super easy to actually actually do this. Because by putting it in the DBCL, it's not just the act of putting it there. It's also the act of, okay, now we have these types in there. If I design a new API, which datetime type should I use? Mm-hmm. And like, what guidance would we give people? How does that work when you actually want to target multiple versions of the framework that all of them have them? Like, mm-hmm. should these APIs go everywhere? Well, if they go everywhere, then we now have multiple copies of those. Great, who is in charge of updating those copies? I mean, there's all these decision points that I think will take a while to get there, and that's why it's sometimes useful to just start the project as a simple MSIL-only binary that sits on top that everybody can just take a dependency on, and we can ref that fast. And by us, I mean anybody in the community, doesn't have to be physically us. And then we can see what sticks. And then once we have a design that we're happy with, I think it's much easier to have a conversation on pushing it down. But yeah, when you're really at the bottom, like it's hard because you can't take a dependency on everything all the time. So that's why it takes time.
So how I would sum it up, like there are slightly different view is that there are APIs and things that are actually very tied to the runtime.
Right.
And once you have that, like string is a great example. Like,
yeah.
You're not gonna write your own string, like, you know, unless you want to fork entire CoreFX and entire core CLR and that stuff. That's a lot of work. I don't think that anyone will ever do it. Or, it's
or
a lot of work.
For the matter.
They can, but you know.
Well, they can fork the whole thing. So
they, you know, it's open source. You can do everything, but you know, man, that's a big undertaking, right? So there are, and datetime is another example. So there are APIs that are used everywhere or tied to the runtime. So that's the real core. And there are APIs like the JSON serialization or maybe even XML parser, or pick whatever your favorite, which is right now in .NET Core. It is actually part of .NET standard. And we should think about them, like, why are they actually part or CoreFX, or do they have to ref with that? Would it be better, like, have the same model like for JSON.NET, like pull them out? And then you have actually interesting, questions from community, like, you know, hey, you have this JSON parser, you should change the API to match what JSON.NET has. It's like, yeah, it's gonna, what's the value? Like, it's gonna break the people who use that. And like, isn't better just for people to tell, like, go and use the JSON.NET? Like, yeah, this is kind of like, think we tried, it failed, there's something better, like, forget about it. It's kind of legacy, or it's obsolete, or, you know, it's not gonna get much love. Like, if you want to really innovate, you know, focus over there. We have similar thing, for example, for mail, right? Right now, we're bringing it over in that Net Standard 2.0. You know, lots of applications and tools need to send email. We don't have support for lots of like latest specs and latest like protocols and things, but there's the great thing like MailKit, I believe. It's someone from Xamarin, so technically speaking, it's Microsoft-ish now. I don't know if it's like really side project or really on that. And that's exactly a great thing. You want high performance mailing sending, like latest protocols and that thing, that's the thing you should migrate to. Yeah, if you want just compat, you have your old application that works on desktop and you know some tool, you don't care about performance, you want to send free emails, hey, you know, here's the fork compatibility. But it's not in our interest to kind of bring it into the prime time and like, you know, overshadow the existing external things. That's JSON.NET mail, and there will be plenty of other examples. Mm-hmm. Again, sometimes explaining to people, they will come with the idea, oh, you should definitely implement this, 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 and by the way, this is how you should be motivated. Like, yeah, that's not what we really want to know. That's not the direction we want to go.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I think the only thing that I think we should avoid, which is basically what Java has done, where their core base BBCL wasn't as good as some people wanted it to be. So they pretty quickly started basically having tons of community projects. So there's like plenty of libraries to choose from to do file.io. There's plenty of libraries to choose from for doing IOC. There's plenty of libraries to do daytime. And what happens is like almost similar to C++, you have ultimate flexibility, but it comes with the price that there's no agreement of what the one thing is, which makes it harder to exchange types. But I think to me, this is mostly a question of like, how are things named? Like where, like for example, if JSON not able to live in system.txt, for example, let's just say, I think the majority of the complaints we see today that it's an external library would almost disappear because you wouldn't be able to tell. Like it's a leaky abstraction in the sense that it's done by a community, but it's very visible that it's done by a community and not done by us. And I think that's something we can totally fix by just working with the community. And like, if you look at CoreFX Lab, there's many projects that weren't even done by us, they were done by other people. If we would start taking them and integrating them, even if we ship them as NuGet packages on top of the framework, I don't think anybody would be able to tell, as long as the final new project experience comes with batteries included, then it does.
Which kind of turns to like lots of customers and are looking at like, you know, blessing from Microsoft, right? You know, that's the Microsoft pick, right? You know, so.
But that's the thing.
And that's the system namespace. That's basically naming, right?
But I think the blessing is the thing that everybody wants, but at the same time, I think sometimes people forget that the blessing is not just us saying yes, it's also, well, now we pick up the owners of, you know, fixing bugs, versioning that, and like that. And we want to be careful which ones we pick the commitment for, because we can't, you know, fix everything, right? That doesn't work.
All right. And we are out of time.
I think so. Yeah. Yes. We're actually over time.
Yeah, we are. It's hard to stop you guys.
We're passionate.
Yeah, exactly. Come on. That's great. All right. So thanks for being here today. And you can come back anytime. And
we will.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the people on Twitter should probably tell us what we should talk about.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So, people of the internet, let us know what you would like to see on the show in future shows. You can use the, where is the marker?
And I have one hidden.
It's hidden.
Oh,
well, anyway, it's hashtag onnet, O-N-N-E-T. And don't worry.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kendra. we'll see you again next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.